I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, September 17th, and as we record this in the early evening, global cases of COVID-19 are approaching 30 million. Up nearly 4 million on our last episode 2 weeks ago. The global death toll now stands at over 942,000, up 78,000 in that fortnight. The Department of Health recorded an additional 240 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the last 24 hours. One further person who was diagnosed with the virus has died, so the death toll here now stands at 1,789, up 12 since our last episode. While the overall number of cases in that time has risen by nearly 3,000 to over 32,000. On this episode, why have deaths from the virus not kept pace with new spikes in the way they did 6 months ago? I'll be talking to Monica Gandhi shortly. She's Professor of Medicine and an expert in infectious diseases at the University of California, San Francisco, so stay with us for that. But first, let's go to our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers, on tonight's developments. Big news today, Fergal, certainly in terms of NPHET's advice to government. We had, at the beginning of the week, accusations at the government that there was a lack of clarity over whether Dublin was level 2 plus while the rest of the country stayed on level 2. NPHET's now going the whole hog and says Dublin should go to just level 3 straight away.
Yes, NPHET met this morning and finished, I think, just at lunchtime, and it has advised that Dublin be moved to the level 3 risk rating of the COVID-19 plan, which was published on Tuesday. Now, no other county would see its rating changed under this advice, so the rest of the country would remain at level 2. For Dublin, there will be some additional measures as yet unspecified. We haven't seen those yet. And obviously so-called wet pubs would remain closed in Dublin. The NPHET recommendations, they're being discussed this evening by an oversight group, a new group which will then advise government on, you know, what to implement, how to implement it. So all of this will go to the special cabinet subcommittee tomorrow morning, and then there's supposed to be a full cabinet meeting in the afternoon to decide on it all.
Right.
But I think you'd expect any changes probably to come into effect, you know, at midnight, maybe tomorrow night.
Okay, well, we'll have a run through the measures for any of the listeners who aren't familiar with Level 3. It'll be their priority to keep schools, childcare facilities open. That obviously facilitates people going to work. A number of services to be moved online, cultural venues, museums. As you said, their restrictions will apply to restaurants and pubs, with the wet pubs remaining closed. People will be asked to stay in their region and keep the number they meet to a minimum. What do they mean by that? I mean, how far can you, is it you can travel within Dublin, or have they got into that level of detail yet?
Well, the recommendation, the position of level 3 is stay in your county, really. So stay in County Dublin, that visitors from only one other household to your home or to your garden. You could only have 25 people attending a wedding. Work from home unless it's absolutely necessary to go to your workplace, business. On sports, there's no matches or events with some limited exemptions.
Elite sports, they say, which presumably team sports that are televised, basically.
National rugby and those teams. And then additional restrictions has yet to be specified for indoor dining and hotel services limited only to residents. So, you know, quite a bit. We have to see the exact detail of what is it decided, you know, and that'll be heard tomorrow.
And religious services moving online again, people watching religious services on the webcam, and 25 at a funeral. So that's quite the restriction there as well. In terms of education, higher education, they're asking people to migrate the lectures online.
Remotely.
This didn't come on us all of a sudden. It has been creeping up for quite a while, and there has been some serious concern expressed by public health experts over the last while.
Yes, I mean, when you look at the counties with the highest 14-day incidence rate per 100,000 people. Like Dublin, 104 cases for every 100,000 people. Louth, 76.8. Leitrim, 71.8. Waterford, 64.6. Offaly, 61.6. Limerick, 58.5. And so you can see it's not just obviously about Dublin, but Dublin, you know, is certainly leading in terms of cases. And if you look at today's cases, there were 240 announced this evening. Half of those are in Dublin. So Dublin has 119 cases. And we heard one further death, sadly, today. That means there have now been 15 deaths in September compared with 4 in August. And that's, you know, that's concerning. And then there's a higher proportion now of the overall cases being seen in older age groups, which is also a concern.
Yeah, because heretofore there had been a lot of the cases had been amongst younger people whose survival rate has been a lot better. When it starts to get into the older age groups, that's more concerning in terms of hospitalizations and possibly even fatalities, even though fatalities so far, and actually we'll be having a look at the issue of fatalities around the world in the latter half of this podcast. As you say, fatalities haven't been following the case instance in the way they did the first time round.
No, but what happens is that if you start to see more cases in the community, it will seed into nursing homes and the vulnerable groups. So we're already seeing a rise from a small base, it must be said, but a rise nonetheless of case numbers in hospitals and in intensive care units. So like today, 73 confirmed cases in hospitals, of which 14 are in intensive care units. We haven't seen those figures since mid-June, actually. And that compares a week ago with 51 confirmed cases in hospitals and 7 in intensive care units. And there's also 106 suspected cases in hospitals. So, you know, overall, the numbers are growing. If they were to rise notably in hospitals, that would put pressure on the system again.
Yeah, well, also the time of year we're at, we're coming into the colder weather when respiratory illnesses generally would be a concern. And we also have the problem, obviously, of non-COVID treatment being done in hospitals at the moment, which means that intensive care unit beds are under greater pressure. What do we have, 49 at the moment, which isn't a huge amount when you consider the rising case numbers.
So I was asking questions at the HSE weekly briefing, which was on this afternoon, about intensive care unit beds. And when you look at today's daily report, operational report from the HSE, there are 281 adult intensive care unit beds open and staffed now. But at the 1st of September, there was 356 open and staffed. So that's
What's
75
happened?
Fewer. Well, the explanation from the HSE really is that in terms of the number of intensive care unit beds, they say the main thing is to ensure that there's a sufficient number on any given day, and that on certain days staff might be deployed to other units. But in any event, they are looking to put in place further intensive care unit beds under the winter plan for the health service, which was due to be published today, but has been delayed to finalise a few elements to next week.
Right. We heard about that. This is the plan that's going to be backed by €600 million of investment. Although the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, saying as he was announcing it that less could be done for that €600 million. This isn't really getting ahead of the curve. It's kind of treading water in a way, isn't it? Because theatres and the like can't be used to the same capacity they would have been used in the pre-COVID era.
No, I mean, it is a problem. And we see the waiting lists are already now at record levels, about 820,000 people waiting for some sort of care at hospital. The large proportion of that, you know, over 600,000 people are actually waiting to be seen at an outpatient clinic. So the health system can't move at the pace it used to move at and see people as fast or do treatments as fast as it could while COVID-19 remains a major issue.
Right. I was listening to proceedings in the House of Commons there, Fergal. Just today, actually, I was listening back to some of what was going on yesterday at Prime Minister's Question Times, and Boris Johnson was emphasising over and over again that Britain had the best testing rate in Europe, and he was trying to answer opposition questions about the level of testing in Britain. He was saying it was had made huge strides. Comments by Paul Reid at that HSE briefing earlier wouldn't have gone down well with the UK Prime Minister had he heard what Paul Reid had to say.
If you see what's happening across Europe, you don't have to look too far, actually, just to the UK. What's happening with their testing and tracing system which is an almost collapse, a shutting down of swabbing centres. Earlier this week, I was contacted by very senior officials in the NHS seeking could the Irish Health Service do some testing and laboratory testing for themselves.
Well, the NHS officials contacted the HSE this week about seeking help for COVID-19 testing in the UK. Because, as you know, in Britain, some people are having to travel hundreds of miles for tests. And Paul Reid said he was contacted this week informally about providing help. And he said the NHS test and trace system was almost collapsed, and they were also shutting down some swabbing centres. Now, he told the UK officials that Ireland isn't in a position to help because we build up our capacity for Ireland and not for other countries. And, so they have their difficulties.
Right. It was nice to be asked, and it was a handy way for Paul Reid to deflect questions about what the state of play was with Ireland. But he was saying that we had built up capacity in Ireland and we weren't as bad as the UK. But as you say, not in a position to help there. Fergal, Neffet's advice ultimately now tomorrow will go to Cabinet. Do we expect any gap between what Neffet has to say and what Cabinet will have to say? What's expected here? Do we expect full implementation, or do we know at this stage what will happen?
Well, this new oversight group is a filtering group. It's chaired by the Secretary General of the Department of the Taoiseach. Paul Reid, the HSE chief, is also on it, and other officials. But it's the first meeting of it. We don't know whether we will see minutes of those meetings, what was discussed. And, you know, when it's gone through that filter, what will come out the other end? Obviously, the oversight group will have to look at the implications for any recommendations for Irish business and society. So it takes, looks at the public health advice and recommendations and then takes a wider view and will advise government. But we'll hear tomorrow and we will hear by tomorrow afternoon, evening, what the decision of the cabinet is. And you would expect that they'll accept the move to level 3, especially given that Neffet made some strong recommendations five days ago, really, and there's been a delay, really, and I suppose the criticism is there was a delay in moving on that, and we're now 5 days on and the case numbers are growing even further, so I think we'll see it accepted, but we'll have to wait for the exact detail.
And by some standards, Neffet's advice is a moderate stance. Dr. Ray Wally, I think formerly head of the GP committee in the IMO, calling for Dublin to go to level 4.
Well, there was some pressure on that today to move to level 4. You don't want to be changing levels too often either, because that may cause some confusion. So you might expect that, how long would Dublin stay on level 3? Well, that may be for a couple of weeks. We don't know how long the measures will be in place. But if we're heading into a situation where indeed other counties will see their levels changing, the pace at which that's going to happen is going to be an issue.
Right. There certainly won't be too many Dublin Drive for 5 T-shirts be seen anytime soon. Now, as you'll have been seeing in the news, COVID-19 cases have been spiking for a second time in many countries around the world. Israel, which initially kept infection levels low, has entered another lockdown. Spikes have also been seen in France and Spain and indeed in other countries. But fatalities haven't followed these spikes in the same way they mirrored each other when Italy's Lombardy region was in the front line back in the spring. So why is this? That's exactly what Monica Gandhi has been examining. She's a professor of medicine specialising in infectious diseases in the University of California, San Francisco. So, Monica, you are professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and your speciality is infectious diseases. HIV is the big ticket item in your field of expertise.
Correct.
But when COVID came on the scene, how did you switch to that, or how did this land on your desk?
Yes, I mean, essentially, since I'm an HIV doctor, and so much of HIV is about behavior. Right? I'm an infectious disease doctor, but I'm also an HIV doctor. And so much of HIV is about prevention, treatment, but also behavior, taking a pill every day, wearing a condom at the beginning. You know, there are things that have to do with behavior. And so is COVID-19. COVID-19 has to do with prevention and treatment. And the prevention aspect is about behavior. It's about keeping away social distancing. It's about cohorting. It's about masking. And so in a way, it becomes an interesting thing to talk about.
Let's identify the problem or the question you wanted to answer and what you were curious about as we find ourselves in this second spike.
Someone put it really nicely to me the other day that we are no longer in a shutdown situation where we think we're going to eradicate COVID-19. We actually, even Vietnam, after 4 months, saw cases again with the best control measures they could think of. And now we are in a dance. We are in a dance with COVID-19. And that means it becomes a lot about personal risk taking, fear, personal biases, and personal ability to employ the preventative health measures that we now know so well. That will protect us from SARS-CoV-2 transmission and likely severe disease. And that's mask wearing and social distancing and staying around people you know and cohorting. And if you want to be around other people, staying outside and if you can, and wearing a mask inside. And there are many, many preventative health measures. And the reason it's similar to HIV is that after HIV spread into different populations, it became a personal negotiation with risk and a personal negotiation with what people are willing to do for prevention. And as treatments got better, people were not as scared of HIV. That isn't necessarily a good thing, but that's what happened. And so there are many similarities, I think. I also think many of the HIV doctors are those that are working on COVID-19 because many HIV doctors are infectious disease doctors like myself. And I also think that it is becoming about behavior. Something as simple as mask wearing is not at all simple, it seems. And neither was condom wearing. It's not easy to just tell everyone to wear a condom. It was a very personal thing. And in the case of mask wearing, it's a more public activity. It's not an intimate activity. And I think that it lends itself to things that we never would have dreamed of with condoms, which is things like mandates and enforcement and negative and positive reinforcement. I was just on a call with mayors across the United States, and some of them said, we're giving out like a $5 gift card in stores when you come in with a good mask. There's positive reinforcement and there's fines. And there's people in many countries who are imposing fines on people who don't wear masks. So it lends itself to a whole other complex mass behavior change movement that is not exactly like HIV, but there are similarities.
All right. Okay. Well, you've looked at a couple of countries. Let's look at the case instance rate in countries and insofar as that's reliable. So countries that do testing that have shown spikes this time round, the death rate is not following that. And you kind of wanted to have a look at that and see, well, why is that? And there's a couple of ideas behind it. Some people have said, well, younger people are getting infected, so it must be that. What have you been finding out? What did you examine, first of all? What countries did you look at and what patterns did you see?
Yeah, I mean, the country level data is very fascinating because we're becoming sort of, mass experiments, across the planet. And absolutely that the countries that employed universal masking at the very beginning have very low rates of severe illness. And then depending on how much they kept social distancing, very low rates of transmission. But often as they opened up society, they would see the cases, but they wouldn't see the severe illness because they're opening up with masking, which I think is suggestive of this theory that it decreases severe illness by reducing the viral dose that you get exposed to. And so Taiwan is a country that I love to think about because it was, mass-produced masks on March 6th, changed all their factories to mass-producing facial masks, and they, a country of 23 million right next to, at that time, a very large epicenter of the epidemic, which is China, and they've had less than 10 deaths. I mean, Taiwan is an amazing country to look at. Vietnam is an interesting country to look at. They didn't do as much testing. They just couldn't afford it. That they did a lot of also compliance with masking, and they really got down to very few cases, and in fact, zero for 4 months. So I think I've always been fascinated by what the Asian countries are doing. We don't talk about them enough. And then of Czech Republic, I always bring up. I just was very mighty of the Czech Republic to very early on March 23rd, mandate masking. That was earlier than April 18th for Germany and other places. I mean, it was the Czech Republic was the little European country that could.
What of those theories? First of all, in your opinion and based on what you've seen, has the disease changed to the extent that it's got less virulent or less harmful? Why isn't that the reason?
That to me just doesn't biologically make sense. That you know you can get antigenic variability in influenza because it has a very leaky, what's called leaky polymerase, what replicates the virus. These coronaviruses usually don't mutate at such a fast rate. And so you can change some little things about it, but to make it, it does not biologically make sense that this has become a less virulent virus. Instead, what biologically makes sense is that to greater or lesser degrees, we've done a number of strategies to mitigate its impact. And we've totally slapped on masks in a way that we haven't for like 100 years. And we have increased testing in many places and we have protected our vulnerable better. And I think that is why it's gotten better.
Right. And the younger age group, why didn't you see that as the key determinant in terms of, you know, the infection rates?
I did. I thought that people being infected when they were younger was going to be the main reason. It's just that I was, you know, there's some data that's contrary to that. And again, I do really respect the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at the University of Oxford. And it was they who put this data together that these falling mortality rates are in all ages, at least in Europe. They haven't looked at the United States. So, no, I actually thought the younger age would be a big reason.
Right. Okay. Well, look.
But I'm just looking at the data.
So the mask wearing thing, I mean, let's drill into that a bit because you did a fair bit of it on your talk. So you can become infected with a mask. You can potentially shed the virus with a mask. But what it comes down to is the amount of virus you are exposed to determines how bad a dose of COVID-19 you get. Will you explain that?
Yes. I mean, that is the theory that we're putting forth. Again, it's a theory. I want to stress that from the beginning. But there are sort of three layers of evidence around that theory that in animal models, at least, the less of a viral dose you get in or inoculum, the less sick you get. And that is true of animal models dating back from 1938, including in a hamster model of this very virus, SARS-CoV-2, that the less virus you get in, the less sick you get. Then you put on top of it that masking does reduce the amount of dose. We call it viral dose or viral inoculum, not load, but dose or inoculum, the amount of dose you get because it filters out viral particles from getting into your system.
And they actually put the masks on hamsters for this, which is another podcast entirely, potentially, the idea of masking
especially,
hamsters.
Yes, especially since I have a picture of a little tiny masked hamster from that talk that you saw, who I think is like the cutest thing that's ever come out of COVID-19. This little, I don't know where I got it actually, but this little hamster with this little mask. That was the study from the University of Hong Kong that looked like masking reduced both transmission to the hamsters when they simulated masking, but also those who got sick got less sick than those who didn't have masks. So some virologic and animal model level data there. And then the epidemiologic evidence is, you know, we mentioned it there, but, you know, that in a cruise ship outbreak where everyone masked, the rate of people who didn't have symptoms was twice the rate that before. So 40% asymptomatic rate baseline, but 81% asymptomatic rate in this Argentinian cruise ship that everyone masked. And then the food processing plant example in the United States, where there's a lot of illness at the beginning, people started mandating masking, giving out masks. And now in two big outbreaks in the US, the rate of asymptomatic infection, not having symptoms, was 95%. And then I get emails from all around the world like, oh, wow, once we started masking our populations, we saw less illness. This is true of a healthcare study that was just published by the CDC that we wear surgical masks now routinely at all times in the clinic and hospital, and we've probably been infected more than we think because there's increased seroprevalence, but we didn't know it because there's less symptoms. There was a CDC study recently that dining or, you know, off your mask is associated with risk of symptomatic disease, but places where you can mask, people didn't get symptoms. So there's a lot of observational evidence, and then the country level evidence we talked about. So it's a theory, it's putting together a lot of ideas, but I think that it's a it's one that's gaining some traction.
Right. The issue of herd immunity has become, you know, kind of quite a controversial thing, especially in the arguments with, say, over Sweden. But what you've looked at is herd immunity is not a dirty word or a dirty phrase, I suppose, to be more correct about it. But if it is, if the virus is transmitted in low doses amongst a large cohort of people, you could have asymptomatic transmission and herd immunity achieved without people falling ill to the extent as if they just mingled, as if nothing was happening. Am I summarizing what your argument was correctly?
Yes, you summarized it well. I would definitely not want to get to herd immunity any other way. I would not want to get to herd immunity through severe illness. That would be terrible and absolutely counter to my, you know, duty as an infectious disease doctor. So absolutely do not believe in letting the populace go and let it spread wildly. But the idea of masking, if that could bring down our rates of severity of illness, but because asymptomatic infection has been shown to have some good immunity developing for a while, we don't know how long, it could be lowering the number of people who are susceptible in the population, and that is the definition of herd immunity until we get to a vaccine. I have no idea how long natural immunity will last. That's why vaccine development is truly the pillar of trying to long-term control this virus.
And then in tandem with that, you've also looked at, but it may be too early to tell, the better treatments that are in hospital, but also then preventative measures in care and clinical settings, infection control and testing.
Absolutely. No doubt that testing in vulnerable populations, in closed settings like nursing homes, testing and treating our vulnerable, better treatments, dexamethasone, remdesivir, all the treatments that are coming out, I am positive that those are very mainstays of why we're seeing reduced mortality.
But the key to all of this in terms of keeping the dose that people get low and to try and keep the harmful levels of the virus low, you can take all the precautions with social distancing and everything else, but really you've concluded masking is absolutely key if people are to live with COVID-19.
I do. I think it's key. I think it's absolutely key.
Okay, listen, Monica, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
We really appreciate it. All the best.
Best of luck with all your protective noise-making small creatures in your home.
Thank you very much. All the best.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Okay.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter @colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.